Thanks for downloading Scott Harold's podcast. If you use a smart speaker, you can always ask Alexa to enable the SOS radio skill.
When it comes to biology and science, you know, I'm not even going to pretend to know what I'm talking about when it comes to viruses. But you know what? I invited Dr. Scott Todd to be with us this morning on SOS. Dr. Todd serves as a president of OneChild.org, which is a degree in microbiology and a doctorate in immunology. Good morning, Dr. Todd.
Good morning, Scott. Great to be with you.
You know, you've done some groundbreaking medical research with Stanford University Medical Center, with the National Science Foundation, the American Cancer Society, and it's so tough to discern all the fact from fiction when everybody's talking about COVID-19 saying, hey, you need to be freaking out about right now.
Yeah, there's a difference between information and how we interpret information, right? There's facts and then there's meaning. And unfortunately, you know, the facts are, yes, SARS-CoV-2, which is the new member of the coronavirus family that recently emerged, causes the disease known as COVID-19. Yeah, it's a nasty virus. And we're beginning to have some really accurate facts about just how dangerous is it. You hear a lot about the antibody studies that are going on. That's to find out what is the true infection rate. Right now, we only have reliable info on case rate. But infection rate is really asking the question, if I get infected, what are the odds that I survive? And right now that answer is around 99.8%. And that's coming out of those serological studies. So the question of meaning, though, that may be a fact, but does that mean I should be afraid? If I told you it was 99% instead of 99.8%, would I be four times more fearful? That's the hard part. And that's really where everybody's interpreting it. And it is generating a lot of fear. And that's actually causing more harm than good, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's so interesting because there's the infection rates and everyone's concerned about that. And it's okay to be concerned because concern is wisdom. And we're going to pattern our life and our strategy around that. But we're not supposed to dig into the fear and the anxiety. And that's when it gets devastating for all of us, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not meant for fear. We're meant for faith. And we're not meant to be anxious people. We're meant to live with the confidence that comes from that faith. We're not meant for isolation. We're meant for relationship. And those are very important fundamentals that we need to keep our eyes on.
Now, we're talking with Dr. Scott Todd from OneChild.org today at SOS Radio. They're a child development organization that mobilizes a whole global community of child champions to help kids thrive and break the cycle of poverty. And he's also an award-winning scientist and medical researcher. He actually helped pioneer some research that led to the discovery of a treatment for the hepatitis C infection. But Dr. Todd, as it relates to COVID-19, that's what's on everybody's mind right now. What makes finding a vaccine or a treatment so complicated? And long.
Well, in the case of coronaviruses in general, so first we can say SARS-CoV-2, new member of the coronavirus family. Yes, it's new, but the coronavirus family is not. And we have decades of experience doing research. We understand what a coronavirus looks like, its structure, its envelope, the spike proteins, how they bind to their target receptors on cells, all kinds of knowledge that we have. We know what kind of immune responses happen to other coronaviruses, not so much in detail about SARS-CoV-2 yet. So all that to say, we do understand a lot. We have a good starting point with the production of a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2. However, it typically takes years for us to develop and deploy an effective vaccine. In the meantime, one of the things that's going on right now is that everybody who gets infected and recovers, that's 99% of us who get infected and recover, we have effectively been vaccinated. It's the real deal. We now have immunological memory. And although we haven't seen that people who are demonstrating immunological memory will defend themselves against subsequent infections, it's very reasonable to expect that they will. Otherwise, there's no point in having a vaccine either. All vaccines do is imitate the infection and provoke that immunity, that memory, and then your immune system just defends you faster. You actually do get infected technically, but you don't feel it because your immune system defends you so fast you don't get symptoms. So vaccine development is a possibility. We certainly hope and pray that that'll happen, but it's not something that's going to happen in the next 18 months. I'd be shocked. I mean, I know there's some optimistic claims out there about a speedier pace. The bottom line is that the more people who become infected and recover, and again, I would estimate 99% of us who become infected will recover, and I can talk more about the details of that if you like. The risk is lower than most people realize. Then we're immune, and then we get a significant portion of the population that has that immunity. It's called herd immunity, and it makes it more difficult for the virus to hop around from one person to another, and that basically protects those who are not yet infected. So our strategy really should focus on protecting the most vulnerable people, people who are immunocompromised or especially the elderly.
We're talking with Dr. Scott Todd from OneChild.org today at SWIS Radio. We were talking about COVID-19, and everyone's talking about the vaccination, almost like this is the be-all, end-all solution to the COVID-19 problem. But do you see it a little differently as just the solution?
Absolutely. I would not say that the vaccine is the solution. It would be great if we had one and if it was effective. But if you look at influenza, for example, we've been working on effective influenza vaccines for many years. There's strain variation. You go back and get your flu shot every year, at least some people do. And even with that, you know, you're 30, 40, maybe on a good year, 50% effective. So I really wouldn't say we should put our hopes in a vaccine. However, if you look at recovery rates, that is the actual number of infections and not the same as the case rate. What's being reported very widely right now is the case rate. And let me tell you the difference. A person becomes infected with the virus and they get sick enough to go to a hospital or clinic where they are tested and confirmed, or these days there's been an adjustment, which I think is a little bit risky, where they're diagnosed as probable or suspected COVID-19. And that's called a case. Okay. And if you look at the, say, mortality rate or the fatality rate by cases, it's looking like 4%, which may scare you. It is high. It is scary. But if you actually said, well, how many people got infected but never got sick enough or didn't show symptoms or just got better, and therefore we didn't ever know. We didn't test to confirm that they had it. We didn't even know to test them. Well, how many people is that? And the answer is it's definitely much, much higher than the number of people who've been confirmed positive as a case. And why is that such good news? It's this. Because the higher that actual infection rate, then the lower the infection fatality rate, meaning instead of saying 4% chance of dying, you're probably looking at closer to 0.2%, maybe up to 0.4%. And the way we know the answer to that is after people have been infected, they have antibodies. That's been shown in a number of different studies already. The presence of those antibodies means you encountered the virus, you kicked its tail, and now you have immunological memory. Hopefully that memory makes you resistant or defends you against a future infection. So by seeing that a larger percentage of the population, maybe 50-fold higher than the case rate, has already encountered it and is now resistant, that's your vaccine. And it's just the way you defend yourself against every other infection that ever comes around. I mean, you've been facing microbial threats every day since you were born. Since the day of your birth, there's been bacteria and viruses and parasites, fungi, things that would be a threat to your health, microbial pathogens. And you have defended yourself day after day. You're defending yourself again today. Every now and then, one of those little boogers gets an upper hand for a week or two and you get sick. But if you're still alive and listening to this, then you have been winning that battle because you have an immune system that is an army. It has T cells and B cells and has antibodies like cruise missiles that hit their targets, has hand grenades. These T cells have cytotoxic enzymes that they throw at infected target cells. It's an extraordinary army that God has designed the human body to have. That's how you defend yourself. And guess what? It has worked for everything else. It is going to work against SARS-CoV-2. Unfortunately, the percentage of fatalities is higher with SARS-CoV-2, but it's really something where we should focus on the most vulnerable, mainly those who are older than 65 or 70 years old. That risk of fatality is definitely higher. So I don't put my hope in a vaccine. I put my hope in God. And I also know that God gave us this awesome immune system. And so I just walk forward with courage and trust that the same immune system that's defended me every day of my life is going to continue to do so today.
It's been such a strange season because there's so much in the news is cause for concern. And when we embrace concern, that's fine because there's wisdom in building strategy and thinking through how we live our life and the decisions that we're going to make to protect our family. But we don't want to go into a place where we lose all of our hope because fear and anxiety have just gripped us. And we're actually talking with Dr. Scott Todd. He works with onechild.org and he's an immunologist and a medical researcher. And Dr. Todd, you've seen all kinds of virus threats over the years. You've seen how people bounce back. You've seen the resilience of our bodies. But what keeps hope front and center for you?
Well, that's such an awesome question. Thank you, Scott. Yeah, hope is so, so important. And it is so often underestimated or overlooked. And when I think about hope, the verse from Romans 15, 13, may the God of hope fill you with joy and peace as you trust in him so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. That verse has so much packed into it. Number one, it says that God is the God of hope. This is a prayer for us, really, that he will fill us with joy and peace as we trust in him. And so it talks about where are we placing our trust? Because that's tied directly to where is our hope. And then there's a so that, and I think a lot of people might be tempted to clip that last part of the verse off, but it is for a reason. There's a purposefulness to this prayer that we would be filled with joy and peace from the God of hope so that we may overflow with hope. I'd ask, what does that even mean? What does it mean to overflow with hope? And one of the things that's a common mistake is people tend to see hope as like having a dream or, you know, wishful thinking or an optimism or just positivity. And hope is so much more than that, right? I mean, you hear in 1 Corinthians 13, these three remain, faith, hope, and love. We talk a lot about faith. We talk a lot about love and the four Greek words for that. We tend not to talk so much and so seriously about hope, like it's the overlooked middle child there in the equation. Hope is much more than positivity or optimism. Hope isn't just, I can imagine a better future, because a lot of people can have a fantasy, right? I mean, all of us can imagine a better future, but you know, it doesn't drive any action. It doesn't cause us to do anything. In fact, it can cause despair. A lot of people who can see a better future, but don't think there's any way to get there, that actually causes despair, not hope. The difference between hope and wishful thinking is action. And the reason that action happens is because there is a way, and there has to be a way. Vision without a way to get there is not hopeful, but a vision of a better place, a problem solved, you know, getting through this situation, combined with a way to get there, action that you can take, well, that is starting to become what hope really is all about. But that's not the whole picture yet, because here's the thing. You could see a better future. There's a way to get there. It is guaranteed that way is hard. Why? Because if it was easy, you would have already done it. Hope only exists in the face of a trial. So when you see a better future and you see a way to get there, if there's something that has you stuck, something that's causing you to look down that path and say, I'm not going, what is that? Well, you're going to label some barrier. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if people laugh? Or what if I run out of money and I can't do it? Or what if? You know what the real barrier is? The barrier on that path is fear. And that's why the third requirement for hope is courage. Hope is vision for a better future, a way to get there, and the courage to try. And we at One Child are in the hope construction business. We take hope very seriously. So we're helping kids to see a vision for their better future, develop that vision, define it, get it crystal clear, make it so compelling you could reach out and just grab it. And how are you going to get there? What are you going to do? Because if you don't have a way to get there, you're just going to lay in bed. You're going to lay there having your dream, having your fantasy. No, you have to have a way to get there. It's no guarantee you're going to succeed, but that's the uncertainty that hope drives you through, because it gets you out of bed, gets you on the path, causes you to be resilient, bounce back when things don't go well. And that is courage and grit. And that's what kids have to overcome extreme poverty. And it's what we have to get through the circumstances that we face even today.
We're talking with Dr. Scott Todd today at SWS Radio. And he's an immunologist and a medical researcher. And he's also the president of onechild.org. And they're a global community that serves and develops children in poverty all across the world so that these children can reach their God-given potential. And I know when we hear about all the coronavirus stuff in the news, there's a lot of children overseas that are vulnerable because they do have compromised immune systems and they're living in poverty and their family doesn't have the funding to take care of basic medical needs that a lot of us just take for granted. What are you seeing around the world, Dr. Todd?
Yeah, Scott, unfortunately, as much as SARS-CoV-2 and the COVID-19 pandemic is a public health issue, and it, obviously we're all very aware of the impact that it's having on people's health and well-being, the real issue for the extreme poor around the world is the economic issue. And here's why. You see, they already face daily threat from microbial pathogens. I mean, they hear about a new virus and they're like just added to the list. I mean, they already face malaria and they face diseases that are in the contaminated drinking water that those could kill them. And just this long list of risks, including microbes like viruses and fungi, bacteria, those things like SARS-CoV-2, they face that type of risk every day. But what's different now is the government came and said, you can't leave your home. And these are people that those economic shutdowns, many of us, well, we can go panic shopping at Walmart and clear out the shelves and load up our pantries and refrigerators and whatever else, or we get a government stimulus check. That is not the reality for the majority of the people who live in this world, especially the extreme poor. These are day laborers. They literally work daily to earn $5 a day, maybe, and that is their daily bread. So when you tell them you can't go to work, when you shut down the bus system, when you do those things that help that prevent them from earning their daily income, they literally don't have food to eat. That's the crisis they face. Yeah. And I had the conversation with a guy in the Philippines said, you know, I'd rather take my risk with the virus than stay at home and starve. So that's the reality these kids face. They've already lived under threat. We could learn a lot from their faith and resilience. We could learn a lot from how is it that they go out and face a world of risk every single day when they have nothing to fall back on. They don't have pantries. They don't have Walmart down the street. They don't even have a refrigerator. Some of them don't even have electricity. So when you lock out daily labor and lock out daily income, you lock out daily bread. And One Child has responded to that. For the 40,000 kids and their families that we serve, we've been able to mobilize about $250,000 in our Children in Crisis Fund just to meet food security for the most vulnerable, because that's what they really need right now. It's an economic issue.
We're talking with Dr. Scott Todd today. He's president of OneChild.org. They serve children in poverty overseas and help break that cycle every single day. A few years ago, Mike Mead, our donor services director here at SOS, he and I, we actually took a team of about 40 listeners who wanted to go, and we actually went over to Sri Lanka and visited some of the projects that you have over there. And what was so cool about it was it's the local church, where you work through the local church. And in those situations, like the children that are coming to the centers for school and for nutrition, they don't know it is One Child. They know it is their local church in their village, and that's who's serving and helping their family.
That's exactly right, Scott. That's how we want it. We're not here to build a brand or an organization or any of that. We are here to help kids thrive, and we believe in the local church. So we partner with local churches to equip them and help build capacity, provide resources, and we do that by connecting sponsors to specific children. So if you're sponsoring a child, which I sponsor, my wife and I, a number of kids, those resources go to provide what's needed at the Hope Center so that the child's participation in that Hope Center program, they're receiving comprehensive support. So education, social development, and in the context of that local Christian church, it's spiritual formation as well. So it's a comprehensive long-term program with One Child. And one of the things that I love most about it is its agility. Yes, it works with local churches, and it does that locally. It doesn't do that in some large centralized way. It comes alongside of local ideas, local vision, local initiative, local self-sacrifice. It's not doing for others what they can do for themselves. The groups that we work with, those local communities, they mobilize their own resources. And it may not be much in our eyes, but that's the beauty of it. It's got the dignity of their equity is what we call it. I mean, it's kind of skin in the game to build those Hope Centers and to serve those kids in their communities, because those are their kids. And we know that they love them, and we just want to help them meet those basic needs. So we do believe in the local church. We believe in local decision making, and we come alongside of those local communities to build their capacity for sustainable, long-term generational impact.
It's been such a strange season for nonprofits all over the world, because as people are out of work and they're staying at home, they're not giving in the same way that they were before. Some people are really embracing generosity, but you forget about children living in poverty globally. And OneChild.org is a great organization to invest that in.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're constantly amazed by the generosity of people. And sometimes, in fact, often, it seems like the people who have less are the ones who are more likely to give. And when we work in communities around the world where people have just literally nothing, materially speaking, you know, they have a lot in their hearts, their joy, their faith, but, you know, they may not even have a refrigerator or those basic things that we sort of take for granted, or daily food security. And when we see those communities sharing what they have with one another, it's humbling, it inspires you and breaks your heart and convicts you. I mean, it's all of it. And so we are privileged, and just it fills us with joy to serve this global community of people who are giving of themselves, giving financially, but also giving of their time. The people in the 14 countries where we operate, the people who work with the kids, the teachers and tutors, coaches, pastors, mentors, social workers, we call those folks child champions. And those are the people, they're the real heroes, because they are the ones who know the kids. They walk the alley in the slum. They walk through the gang-infested barrio. They know the situation in the home where there's the abuse. And these courageous people, these child champions, this is how the whole One Child organization works. We're a connection between child champions here in the U.S. who sponsor kids or who are otherwise working for the sake of kids, helping them thrive, connecting them to the child champions from Nicaragua to the Philippines to Kenya, and allowing those resources to flow. Again, as you mentioned earlier, strengthening the capacity of local churches so that churches can help kids in their community to see the gospel both in word and deed, to see the gospel with muscles, proclamation, and demonstration. That's kind of the core of who we are.
We're talking to Dr. Scott Todd today from OneChild.org. If you want to invest in that, that's Swiss Radio. Thanks for calling in today, Dr. Todd.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for downloading the SOS Radio podcast. If you enjoy the discussion and want to help the podcast grow, you can make a $10 donation through sosradio.net or inside the SOS Radio app. Thanks for your generosity. It helps us experiment with new things and keep the discussions fresh.